From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Caterpillars by E.F. Benson. I saw a month ago in an Italian paper that the Via Cascana, in which I once stayed, had been pulled down, and that a manufactory of some sort was in process of erection on its site. There is therefore no longer any reason for refraining from writing of those things which I myself saw, or imagined I saw, in a certain room and on a certain landing of the villa in question, nor from mentioning the circumstances which followed, which may or may not, according to the opinion of the reader, throw some light on, or be somehow connected with this experience. The Via Cascana was in all ways but one, a perfectly delightful house. Yet, if it were standing now, nothing in the world, I use the phrase in its literal sense, would induce me to set foot in it again, for I believe it to have been haunted in a very terrible and practical manner. Most ghosts, when all is said and done, do not do much harm. They may perhaps terrify, but the person whom they visit usually gets over their visitation. They may, on the other hand, be entirely friendly and beneficent, but the appearance in the Via Cascana were not beneficent, and they had made their visit in a very slightly different manner. I do not suppose I should have got over it any more than Arthur Inglis did. The house stood on an ilex-clad hill not far from Sestri del Levante, on the Italian Riviera, looking out over the iridescent blues of that enchanted sea, while behind it rose the pale green chestnut woods that climb up the hillsides till they give place to the pines that, black in contrast with them, crown the slopes. All around it the garden in the luxuriance of mid-spring bloomed and was fragrant, and the scent of magnolia and rose, borne on the salt freshness of the winds from the sea, flowered like a stream through the cool vaulted rooms. On the ground floor, a broad pillared loggia ran around three sides of the house, the top of which formed a balcony for certain rooms on the first floor. The main staircase, broad and of gray marble steps, led up from the hall to the landing outside these rooms, which were three in number, namely two big sitting rooms and a bedroom arranged in suite. The latter was unoccupied. The sitting rooms were in use. From here, the main staircase continued up to the second floor, where were situated certain bedrooms, one of which I occupied, while on the other side of the first floor landing, some half dozen steps led to another suite of rooms, where at the time I am speaking of, Arthur Inglis, the artist, had his bedroom and studio. Thus the landing outside my bedroom, at the top of the house, commanded both the landing of the first floor and also the steps that led to Inglis's room. Jim Stanley and his wife, finally, whose guest I was, occupied rooms at another wing of the house, where also were the servants' quarters. I arrived just in time for lunch on a brilliant noon of mid-May. The garden was shouting with color and fragrance, and not less delightful, after my broiling walk up from the marina, should have been the coming from the reverberating heat and blaze of the day into the marble coolness of the villa. Only, the reader has my bare word for this and nothing more. The moment I set foot in the house, I felt that something was wrong. This feeling, I may say, was quite vague, though very strong, and I remember that when I saw letters waiting for me on the table in the hall, I felt certain that the explanation was here. I was convinced that there was bad news of some sort for me. Yet when I opened them, I found no such explanation of my premonition. My correspondence all reeked of prosperity. Yet this clear miscarriage of a presentiment did not dissipate my uneasiness. In that cool, fragrant house there was something wrong. I'm at pains to mention this because it may explain why it was that, though I am as a rule so excellent a sleeper, that the extinction of a light on getting into bed is apparently contemporaneous with being called on the following morning, I slept very badly on my first night in the Villa Cascana. It may also explain the fact that when I did sleep, if it was indeed in sleep, that I saw what I thought I saw. I dreamed in a very vivid and original manner, original, that is to say, in the sense that something which, as far as I knew, had never previously entered into my consciousness, usurped it then. But since, in addition to this evil premonition, certain words and events occurring during the rest of the day might have suggested something of what I thought happened that night, it will be well to relate them. After lunch, then I went round the house with Mrs. Stanley, and during our tour she referred, it is true, to the unoccupied bedroom on the first floor, which opened out of the room where we had lunched. "We left that unoccupied," she said, "because Jim and I have a charming bedroom and dressing room, as you saw, in the wing, and if we used it ourselves, we should have to turn the dining room into a dressing room and have our meals downstairs. As it is, however, we have our little flat there. Arthur Inglis has his little flat in the other passage, and I remembered, aren't I extraordinary, that you once said that the higher up you were in a house, the better you were pleased. So I put you at the top of the house instead of giving you that room." It is true that a doubt, vague as my uneasy premonition, crossed my mind at this. I did not see why Mrs. Stanley should have explained all this, if there had not been more to explain. I allow, therefore, that the thought that there was something to explain about the unoccupied bedroom was momentarily present to my mind. The second thing that may have borne on my dream was this. At dinner the conversation turned for a moment on ghosts. Inglis, with the certainty of conviction, expressed his belief that anybody who could possibly believe in the existence of supernatural phenomena was unworthy of the name of an ass. The subject instantly dropped. As far as I can recollect, nothing else occurred or was said that could bear on what follows. We all went to bed rather early, and personally, I yawned my way upstairs, feeling hideously sleepy. My room was rather hot, and I threw all the windows open, and from without poured in the white light of the moon and the love song of many nightingales. I undressed quickly and got into bed, but though I had felt so sleepy before, I now felt extremely wide awake. But I was quite content to be awake. I did not toss or turn. I felt perfectly happy, listening to the song and seeing the light. Then, it is possible, I may have gone to sleep, and what follows may have been a dream. I thought, anyhow, that after a time the nightingales ceased singing and the moon sank. I thought also that if, for some unexplained reason, I was going to lie awake all night, I might as well read, and I remembered that I left a book in which I was interested in the dining room on the first floor. So I got out of bed, lit a candle, and went downstairs. I entered the room, saw on a side table the book I had come to look for, and then simultaneously saw that the door into the unoccupied bedroom was open. A curious gray light, not of dawn nor of moonshine, came out of it, and I looked in. The bed stood just opposite the door. A big four-poster hung with tapestry at the head. Then I saw that the grayish light of the bedroom came from the bed, or rather, from what was on the bed, for it was covered with great caterpillars, a foot or more in length, which crawled over it. They were faintly luminous, and it was from the light from them that showed me this room. Instead of the sucker feet of ordinary caterpillars, they had rows of pincers like crabs, and they moved by grasping what they lay on with their pincers and then sliding their bodies forward. In color these dreadful insects were yellowish-gray, and they were covered with irregular lumps and swellings. There must have been hundreds of them, for they formed a sort of writhing, crawling pyramid on the bed. Occasionally one fell off onto the floor with a soft, fleshy thud, and though the floor was of hard concrete, it yielded to the pincer feet, as if it had been putty, and crawling back, the caterpillar would mount onto the bed again to rejoin its fearful companions. They appeared to have no faces, so to speak, but at one end of them there was a mouth that opened sideways in respiration. Then, as I looked, it seemed to me as if they all suddenly became conscious of my presence. All the mouths, at any rate, were turned in my direction, and the next moment they began dropping off the bed with those soft, fleshy thuds on the floor and wiggling towards me. For one second, the paralysis of nightmare was on me, but the next I was running upstairs again to my room, and I remember feeling the cold of the marble steps on my bare feet. I rushed into my bedroom and slammed the door behind me, and then I was certainly wide awake now. I found myself standing by my bed with a sweat of terror pouring from me. The noise of the banged door still rang in my ears. But as would have been more usual if this had been mere nightmare, the terror that had been mine when I saw these foul beasts crawling about the bed or dropping softly onto the floor did not cease then. Awake now, if dreaming before, I did not at all recover from the horror of dream. It did not seem to me that I had dreamed. And until dawn I sat or stood, not daring to lie down, thinking that every rustle or movement that I had heard was the approach of the caterpillars. To them, and the claws that bit into the cement, the wood of the door was child's play. Steel would not keep them out. But with a sweet and noble return of day, the horror vanished, the whisper of wind became benignant again. The nameless fear, whatever it was smoothed out and terrified me no longer. Dawn broke, hueless at first, then it grew dove-colored. Then the flaming pageant of light spread over the sky. The admirable rule of the house was that everybody had breakfast where and when he pleased, and in consequence it was not until lunchtime that I met any of the other members of our party, since I had breakfast on my balcony and wrote letters and other things till lunch. In fact, I got down to that meal rather late, after the other three had begun. Between my knife and fork there was a small pillbox of cardboard, and as I sat down, English spoke. "Do look at that," he said. "Since you are interested in natural history, I found it crawling on my counterpane last night, and I don't know what it is." I think that before I opened the pillbox, I expected something of the sort which I found in it. Inside it, anyhow, was a small caterpillar, grayish-yellow in color with curious bumps and excrescence on its rings. It was extremely active and hurried around the box, this way and that. Its feet were unlike the feet of any caterpillar I ever saw. They were like the pincers of a crab. I looked and shut the lid down again. "No, I don't know it," I said, "but it looks rather unwholesome. What are you going to do with it?" "Oh, I shall keep it," said Inglis. "It has begun to spin. I want to see what sort of a moth it turns into." I opened the box again and saw that these hurrying movements were indeed the beginnings of the spinning of the web of its cocoon. Then Inglis spoke again. "It has got funny feet, too," he said. "They are like crab pincers. What's the Latin for crabs? Oh, yes, Cancer. So, in case it is unique, let's christen it Cancer Inglisianus." Then something happened in my brain, some momentary piercing together of all that I had seen or dreamed. Something in his words seemed to me to throw light on it all, and my own intense horror at the experience of the night before linked itself onto what he had just said. In effect, I took the box and threw it, caterpillar and all, out of the window. There was a gravel path just outside, and beyond it a fountain playing into a basin. The box fell onto the middle of this. Inglis laughed. "So the student of the occult don't like solid facts," he said. "My poor caterpillar." The talk went off again at once onto other subjects, and I have only given in detail as they happened these trivialities in order to be sure myself that I have recorded everything that could have borne on occult subjects or on the subject of caterpillars. But at the moment when I threw that pillbox into the fountain, I lost my head. My only excuse is that, as is probably plain, the tenant of it was in miniature. exactly what I had seen crowded onto the bed in the unoccupied room. And though this translation of those phantoms into flesh and blood, or whatever it is that caterpillars are made of, ought perhaps to have relieved the horror of the night, as a matter of fact it did nothing of the kind. It only made the crawling pyramid that covered the bed in the unoccupied room more hideously real. After lunch we spent a lazy hour or two strolling about the garden or sitting in the loggia, and it must have been about 4 o'clock when Stanley and I started off to bathe down the path that led by the fountain into which I had thrown the pillbox. The water was shallow and clear, and at the bottom of it I saw its white remains. The soaking had disintegrated the cardboard and had become no more than a few strips and shreds of sodden paper. The center of the fountain was a marble Italian cupid, which squirted the water out of a wineskin held under its arm, and crawling up its leg was the caterpillar. Strange and scarcely credible as it seemed, it must have survived the fall into its bits of its prison, and made its way to shore, and there it was, out of arm's reach, weaving and weaving, this way and that way as it evolved its cocoon. Then as I looked at it, it seemed to me again that, like the caterpillars I had seen last night, it saw me, and breaking out of the threads that surrounded it, it crawled down the marble leg of the cupid and began swimming like a snake across the water of the fountain towards me. It came with extraordinary speed. The fact of a caterpillar being able to swim was new to me, and in another moment was crawling up the marble lip of the basin. Just then Inglis joined us. "Why, if it isn't old Cancer Inglis Dennis again," he said, catching sight of the beast. "What a tearing hurry it is in." We were standing side by side on the path, and when the caterpillar had advanced to within about a yard of us, it stopped and began waving again as if in doubt as to the direction it should go in. Then it appeared to make up its mind and crawled onto Inglis's shoe. "It likes me best," he said, "but I don't really know that I like it. And as it won't drown, I think perhaps..." He shook it off his shoe onto the gravel path and trod on it. All the afternoon the air got heavier and heavier with a scirocco that was without doubt coming up from the south, and that night again I went up to bed feeling very sleepy. But below my drowsiness, so to speak, there was the consciousness, stronger than before, that there was something wrong in the house, that something dangerous was close at hand. But I fell asleep at once, and how long after I do not know, either woke or dreamed I awoke, feeling that I must get up at once or I should be too late. Then dreaming or awake I lay and fought this fear, telling myself that I was but the prey of my own nerves, distorted by scirocco's or what not, and at the same time quite clearly knowing, in another part of my mind, so to speak, that every moment's delay added to the danger. At last this second feeling became irresistible, and I put on coat and trousers and went out of my room onto the landing, and then I saw that I had already delayed too long, and that I was now too late. The whole of the landing of the first floor below was invisible under the swarm of caterpillars that crawled there. The folding doors into the sitting room, from which opened the bedroom where I had seen them last night, were shut, but they were squeezing through the crack of it, and dropping one by one through the keyhole, elongating themselves into mere strings as they passed, and growing fat and lumpy again on emerging, some as if exploring or nosing about the steps into the passage at the end of which were Inglis's room, others were calling on the lowest steps of the staircase that led up to where I stood. The landing, however, was completely covered with them. I was cut off, and of that frozen horror that seized me when I saw that, I can give it no idea in words. Then, at last, a general movement began to take place, and they grew thicker on the steps that led to Inglis's room. Gradually, like some hideous tide of flesh, they advanced along the passage, and I saw the foremost, visible by the pale gray luminousness that came from them, reach his door. Again and again I tried to shout and warn him, in terror all the time, that they should turn at the sound of my voice and mount my stair instead, but for all my efforts I felt that no sound came from my throat. They crawled along the hinge crack of his door, passing through as they had done before, and still I stood there, making impotent efforts to shout to him, to bid him escape while there was time. At last the passage was completely empty. They had all gone, and at that moment I was conscious for the first time of the cold of the marble landing on which I stood barefooted. The dawn was just beginning to break in the eastern sky. 6 months later, I met Mrs. Stanley in a country house in England. We talked on many subjects, and at last she said, "I don't think I've seen you since I got that dreadful news about Arthur Inglis a month ago." "I haven't heard," said I. "No? He has got cancer. They don't even advise an operation, for there is no hope of a cure. He is riddled with it, the doctors say." Now, during all these 6 months, I do not think a day had passed on which I had not had in my mind the dreams, or whatever you like to call them, which I had seen in the Via Cascana. "It is awful, is it not?" she continued, "and I can't help feeling that he may have..." "Caught it at the villa?" I asked. She looked at me in blank surprise. "Why did you say that?" she asked. "How did you know?" Then she told me. In the unoccupied bedroom a year before, there had been a fatal case of cancer. She had, of course, taken the best advice and had been told that the utmost dictates of prudence would be obeyed so long as she did not put anybody to sleep in the room, which had also been thoroughly disinfected and newly whitewashed and painted. But A Home Away From Home by Robert Bloch. The train was late, and it must have been past 9 o'clock when Natalie found herself standing all alone on the platform before Hightower Station. The station itself was obviously closed for the night. It was only a way stop, really, for there was no town here, and Natalie wasn't quite sure what to do. She had taken it for granted that Dr. Bracegirdle would be on hand to meet her. Before leaving London, she'd sent her uncle a wire giving him the time of her arrival, but since the train had been delayed, perhaps he'd come and gone. Natalie glanced around uncertainly, then noticed the phone booth which provided her with a solution. Dr. Bracegirdle's last letter was in her purse, and it contained both his address and his phone number. She had fumbled through her bag and found it by the time she walked over to the booth. Ringing him up proved a bit of a problem. There seemed to be an interminable delay before the operator made the connection, and there was a great deal of buzzing on the line. A glimpse of the hills beyond the station through the glass wall of the booth suggested the reason for the difficulty. After all, Natalie reminded herself, this was West Country. Conditions might be a bit primitive. "Hello, hello!" The woman's voice came over the line, fairly shouting above the din. There was no buzzing noise now, and the sound in the background suggested a babble of voices all intermingled. Natalie bent forward and spoke directly and distinctly into the mouthpiece. "This is Natalie Rivers," she said. "Is Dr. Bracegirdle there?" "Whom did you say was calling?" "Natalie Rivers. I'm his niece." "His what, miss?" "Niece," Natalie repeated. "May I speak to him, please?" "Just a moment." There was a pause during which the sound of voices in the background seemed amplified, and then Natalie heard the resonant masculine tones, so much easier to separate from the indistinct murmuring. "Dr. Bracegirdle here. My dear Natalie, this is an unexpected pleasure." "Unexpected? But I sent you a gram from London this afternoon." Natalie checked herself as she realized the slight edge of impatience which had crept into her voice. "Didn't it arrive?" "I'm afraid service is not of the best around here," Dr. Bracegirdle told her with an apologetic chuckle. "No, your wire didn't arrive, but apparently you did." He chuckled again. "Where are you, my dear?" "At Hightower Station." "Oh, dear. It's in exactly the opposite direction." "Opposite direction?" "From Peterby's. They rang me up just before you called. Some silly nonsense about an appendix. Probably nothing but an upset stomach. But I promised to stop round directly just in case." "Don't tell me they still call you for general practice." "Emergencies, my dear. There aren't many physicians in these parts. Fortunately, there aren't many patients either." Dr. Bracegirdle started to chuckle, then sobered. "Look now. You say you're at the station. I'll just send Miss Plummer down to fetch you in the wagon. Have you much luggage?
Only my travel case. The rest is coming with the household goods. By boat.
Boat? Didn't I mention it when I wrote?
Yes, that's right, you did. Well, no matter. Miss Plummer will be along for you directly. I'll be waiting in front of the platform.
What was that? Speak up, I can hardly hear you.
I said I'll be waiting in front of the platform.
Oh, Dr. Bracegirdle chuckled once more. Bit of a party going on here.
Shan't I be intruding, I mean, since you weren't expecting me tonight?
Not at all. They'll be leaving before long. You wait for Plummer.
The phone clicked off, and Natalie returned to the platform. In a surprisingly short time, the station wagon appeared and skidded off the road to halt at the very edge of the tracks. A tall, thin, gray-haired woman, wearing a somewhat rumpled white uniform, emerged and beckoned to Natalie.
"Come along, my dear," she called. "Here, I'll just pop this in back."
Scooping up the bag, she tossed it into the rear of the wagon. "Now, in with you, and off we go." Scarcely waiting for Natalie to close the door after her, the redoubtable Miss Plummer gunned the motor and the car plunged back onto the road. The speedometer immediately shot up to 70, and Natalie flinched. Miss Plummer noticed her agitation at once.
"Sorry," she said. "With doctor out on call, I can't be away too long."
"Oh, yes, the house guest, he told me."
"Did he now?" Miss Plummer took a sharp turn at a crossroads, and the tires screeched in protest, but to no avail. Natalie decided to drown apprehension in conversation.
"What sort of a man is my uncle?" she asked.
"Have you never met him?"
"No. My parents moved to Australia when I was quite young. This is my first trip to England. In fact, it's the first time I've left Canberra."
"Folks with you?"
"They were in a motor smash-up 2 months ago," Natalie said.
"Didn't the doctor tell you?"
"I'm afraid not. You see, I haven't been with him very long." Miss Plummer uttered a short bark, and the car swerved wildly across the road.
"Motor smash-up. Some people have no business behind the wheel. That's what doctor says."
She turned and peered at Natalie.
"I take it you've come to stay then?"
"Yes, of course. He wrote me when he was appointed my guardian. That's why I was wondering what he might be like. It's so hard to tell from letters."
The thin-faced woman nodded silently, but Natalie had an urge to confide.
"To tell the truth, I'm just a little bit edgy. I mean, I've never met a psychiatrist before."
"Haven't you now?" Miss Plummer shrugged.
"You're quite fortunate. I've seen a few in my time. A bit on the know-it-all side, if you ask me. Though I must say, Dr. Bracegirdle is one of the best. Permissive, you know."
"I understand he has quite a practice."
"There's no lack of patience for that sort of thing," Miss Plummer observed, "particularly amongst the well-to-do. I'd say your uncle has done himself handsomely. The house and all, but you'll see." Once again, the wagon whirled into a sickening swerve and sped forward between the imposing gates of a huge driveway, which led towards an enormous house set amidst a grove of trees in the distance. Through the shuttered windows, Natalie caught sight of a faint beam of light, just enough to help reveal the ornate facade of her uncle's home.
"Oh, dear," she muttered, half to herself.
"What is it?"
"The guests. And it's Saturday night. And here I am all mussed from travel."
"Don't give it another thought," Miss Plummer assured her. "There's no formality here. That's what doctor told me when I came. It's a home away from home."
Miss Plummer barked and braked simultaneously, and the station wagon came to an abrupt stop just behind an imposing black limousine.
"Out with you now." With brisk efficiency, Miss Plummer lifted the bag from the rear seat and carried up the steps, beckoning Natalie forward with a nod over her shoulder. She halted at the door and fumbled for a key.
"No sense knocking," she said. "They'd never hear me."
As the door swung open, her observation was amply confirmed. The background noise which Natalie had noted over the telephone now formed a formidable foreground. She stood there hesitant as Miss Plummer swept forward across the threshold.
"Come along, come along."
Obediently, Natalie entered, and as Miss Plummer shut the door behind her, blinked with eyes recently unaccustomed to the brightness of the interior. She found herself standing in a large, somewhat bare hallway. Directly ahead of her was a large staircase. At an angle between the railing and the wall was a desk and chair. To her left, a dark paneled door. evidently leading to Dr. Bracegirdle's private office, for a small brass plate was affixed to it bearing his name. To her right was a huge open parlor, its windows heavily curtained and shuttered against the night. It was from here that the sounds of sociability echoed. Natalie started across the hall towards the stairs. As she did so, she caught a glimpse of the parlor. Fully a dozen guests eddied about a large table, talking and gesturing with the animation of close acquaintance, with one another and with the contents of the lavish array of bottles gracing the tabletop. A sudden whoop of laughter indicated that at least one guest had abused the doctor's hospitality. Natalie passed the entry hastily so as not to be observed, then glanced behind her to make sure that Miss Plummer was following with her bag. Miss Plummer was indeed following, but her hands were empty. And as Natalie reached the stairs, Miss Plummer shook her head. "You didn't mean to go up now, did you?" she murmured. "Come in and introduce yourself." "I thought I might freshen up a bit first." "Let me go on ahead and get your room in order. Doctor didn't give me notice, you know." "Really, it's not necessary. I could do with a wash." "Doctor should be back any moment now." "Do wait for him." Miss Plummer grasped Natalie's arm, and with the same speed and expedition she had bestowed on driving, now steered the girl forward into the lighted room. "Here's Doctor's niece," she announced, "Miss Natalie Rivers from Australia." Several heads turned in Natalie's direction, though Miss Plummer's voice had scarcely penetrated the general conversational din. A short, jolly-looking fat man bobbed towards Natalie, waving a half-empty glass. "All the way from Australia. He extended his goblet. "You must be thirsty. Here, take this. I'll get another." And before Natalie could reply, he turned and plunged back into the group around the table. "Major Hamilton," Miss Plummer whispered. "A dear soul, really. Though I'm afraid he's just a wee bit squiffy." As Miss Plummer moved away, Natalie glanced uncertainly at the glass in her hand. She was not quite sure where to dispose of it. "Allow me." A tall, gray-haired and quite distinguished-looking man with a black mustache moved forward and took the stemware from between her fingers. "Thank you." "Not at all. I'm afraid you'll have to excuse him. The party spirit, you know." He nodded, indicating a woman in extreme decolletage, chattering animatedly to a group of three laughing men. "But since it's by way of being a farewell celebration." "Ah, there you are," the short man, whom Miss Plummer had identified as Major Hamilton, bounced back into orbit around Natalie, a fresh drink in his hand and a fresh smile on his ruddy face. "I'm back again," he announced, just like a boomerang. He laughed explosively, then paused. "I say, you do have boomerangs in Australia? And blackfellows? Saw quite a bit of you, Aussies at Gallipoli. Of course, that was some time ago, before your time, I dare say." "Please, Major," the tall man smiled at Natalie. There was something reassuring about his presence, and something oddly familiar, too. Natalie wondered where she might have seen him before. She watched while he moved over to the Major and removed the drink from his hand. "Now see here," the Major spluttered. "You've had enough, old boy, and it's almost time for you to go." "One for the road," the Major glanced around, his hands waving in appeal. "Everyone else is drinking." He made a lunge for his glass, but the tall man evaded him. Smiling at Natalie over his shoulder, he drew the Major to one side and began to mutter to him earnestly in low tones. The Major nodded in sudden drunken placation. Natalie looked around the room. Nobody was paying the least attention to her except for one elderly woman who sat quite alone on a stool before the piano. She regarded Natalie with a fixed stare that at once emphasized her role as an intruder on a gala scene. Natalie turned away hastily and again caught sight of the woman in the colletage. She suddenly remembered her own desire to change her clothing and peered at the doorway seeking Miss Plummer, but Miss Plummer was nowhere to be seen. Walking back into the hall, she peered up the staircase. "Miss Plummer," she called. There was no response. Then, from out of the corner of her eye, she noted that the door of the room across the hallway was ajar. In fact, it was opening now quite rapidly, and as Natalie stared, Miss Plummer came backing out of the room, carrying something in her hand. Before Natalie could call out again and attract her attention, she had scurried off down the hallway. Natalie crossed before the stairs, meaning to follow her, but found herself halting instead before the open doorway. She gazed in curiously at what was obviously her uncle's consultation room. It was a cozy, book-lined study with heavy, leather-covered furniture, grouped before the shelves. The psychiatric couch rested in one corner near the wall, and near it was a large mahogany desk. The top of the desk was quite bare, save for a cradle telephone and a thin brown loop snaking out from it. Something about the loop disturbed Natalie, and before she was conscious of her movement, she was inside the room, looking down at the desktop. Now she recognized the loop, of course. It was the cord from the phone, and the end had been neatly severed from its connection at the wall. "Miss Plummer," Natalie murmured. That's what she was carrying, a pair of scissors, but what? Why not? Natalie turned just in time to observe the tall, distinguished-looking man into the doorway behind her. "It won't be needed," he said. "After all, I did tell you it was a farewell celebration." And he gave a little chuckle. Again Natalie sensed something strangely familiar about him, and this time it came to her. She'd heard the same chuckle over the phone from the depot station. "But you're playing a joke," she exclaimed. "You're Dr. Bracegirdle, aren't you?"
"No, my dear."
He shook his head as he moved past her across the room. "It's just that no one expected you. We were about to leave when your call came, so we had to say something." There was a moment of silence. Then, "Where is my uncle?" Natalie murmured at last.
"Over here."
Natalie found herself standing beside the tall man, gazing down at what lay in a space between the couch and the wall. An instant was all she could bear. "Messy," the tall man nodded. "Of course, it was all so sudden, the opportunity, I mean. And then they would get into the liquor." His voice echoed hollowly in the room, and Natalie realized the sounds of the party had died away. She glanced up to see them all standing there in the doorway watching. Then their ranks parted. Miss Plummer came quickly into the room, wearing an incongruous fur wrap over the rumpled, ill-fitting uniform.
"Oh my," she gasped. "So you found him?"
Natalie nodded and took a step forward.
"You've got to do something," she said. "Please."
"Yes." But Miss Plummer didn't seem concerned. The others had crowded into the room behind her and stood staring silently. Natalie turned to them in appeal.
"Don't you see?" she cried. "It's the work of a madman. He belongs in the asylum."
"My dear child," murmured Miss Plummer, as she quickly closed and locked the door, and the silent starers moved forward. "This is the asylum."